So it's very nice to be able to chant the Heart Sutra our way. I've been to three. I was at Green Gulch yesterday. I got home on Sunday, and then a friend was having a shuso ceremony at Green Gulch and begged me, please, please, please come. So I staggered up to Green Gulch, and they chant the Heart Sutra a completely different way now. They've retranslated it. And it's a little bit different in Arcata. It's a little bit different in New Mexico. And everything is a little bit different. It's nice that way, actually. So we had good sesshin, good workshops in Arcata on bodhisattva practice. And then I took those notes and gave talks on bodhisattva practice to the New Mexico sesshin for 5 days. And they're all in here, I think. I didn't try to listen to them to see whether they actually are, but I take them. So they can be yours to do as you like. Yes.
Everybody does know, and you saw Britt's announcement, all these talks now are on the website. So there's a link on the right hand side called audio. So you've been very prompt at getting these Tuesday talks out, and presumably we'll have other talks. We'll host them there too, until we run out of space and I need authorization for more website space. But other than that, they'll be up there.
Okay.
Thank you.
So we're still riding the ox home, I think. And I think we're on number 9. Returning to the source. And as I started to say last time, the last three of these are reference to a very ancient concept in Mahayana Buddhism, one of the first concepts, has many, many layers of meaning. And according to Daido Lori, these last three refer to those three bodies of Buddha, they're called. If you've been to Sesshin, the lunch chant names all three bodies of the Buddha, among many other things. As food is about to be served, the head chanter announces, "In the midst of the three treasures with all sentient beings, let us recite the names of Buddha." And then the first three names are the Dharmakaya Vairochana Buddha, Nirmanakaya, Sambhogakaya Ruchana Buddha, Nirmanakaya Shakyamuni Buddha. And then the future Maitreya Buddha, then all Buddhas, past, present, and future, then the Lotus Sutra, then Manjushri, then Samantabhadra, then Avalokiteshvara, then the Prajnaparamita itself. And by that time, the food is in the bowls, but we still don't eat. But that's how we get the food into the bowls, is by chanting all those names for breakfast and lunch. And the first three are the kayas, the Buddha bodies. The first one refers to the ox herding picture number 8, the one with the big empty circle, the enso, transcending the ox, in which body and mind and ox and person and all the ideas about everything is completely contained and transparent, you could say. No longer compulsive or obsessive. It's just all of a piece, rather than this person going out and trying to get that thing and trying to get it under control and becoming something. All of those things fall away, and the whole thing is just present as it is. So that's the Dharmakaya, the absolute basis of reality, how things just are. There's no self and there's no other. We don't have to set ourselves up and project another. It's just what's happening in the middle of everything, you could say. In Zen, it's it's about cosmic consciousness. I guess that's the best way of saying it. And it's embodied. Vairochana is what we chant. This Dharmakaya Vairochana Buddha. And the Vairochana is the Buddha of everything. Not just this universe, but all universes. The untalkaboutableness of everything. There's a statue in, I think, in the Freer of Vairochana Buddha, showing a very tall, very beautiful standing Buddha with a long robe, very long robe, and inscribed on the robe, and it's all, I think it's in bronze, are scenes from life. There's a river running through and a little village and geese and a little pond and people and trees and a forest and mountains. It's how we try to conceive the everything of everything. All as the robe of this Buddha. So you can see a little bit how big it is. It's too big to even talk about. Sometimes they use the analogy of the sun, that the Dharmakaya is like the sun. It's where our life comes from. It's what lives us. Without the sun, there is no life. So this number 9, returning to the source, is then about the second of the kayas, the Sambhoga Kaya. The delight in the truth. Or in the analogy of the sunlight, it's the light of the sun itself as it's reaching and enlivening, you could say, as it's enacting. In the old Indian view of this, the Sambhoga Kaya is the many millions upon millions upon millions of Buddhas, each of them sitting in its Buddha field. That there are infinite numbers of Buddha fields, and each Buddha field has a Buddha. It's another way of talking about how huge everything is. And how, in this case, the truth is enjoyed. You could say the sunlight is enjoyed. It's a way of basking, a kind of blissfulness of life itself as it flourishes in the light. So the picture here of returning to the source is just a willow tree and a river behind it. And the poem is, having returned to the source, effort is over. The intimate self sees nothing outside, hears nothing outside. Still, the endless river flows tranquilly on. The flowers are red. The intimate self. They say sometimes not knowing is the most intimate. Instead of reaching out and commodifying and naming all the things of the world, that at this point the river just flows on as it will. As we sit, there is a kind of return of our mind. The mind that's always projecting itself, always making an effort. With this return, it's a kind of stepping back that Dogen talks about. And beginning to feel where it's coming from. Mind is a very mysterious thing. Thinking is such a strange activity. But as we sit quietly, we begin to really attend to our thought and to where it how it wants to be. And understanding our mind and its activity, we can become much more natural, much more relaxed about how we are. I think a lot of our conditioning is about teaching us to control our mind and our behavior, and it's very easy to create a kind of tension, an uptightness about how we, not only how we behave, but even how we think. And at this stage, there's a kind of seeing the truth of what it's like to be a body with a thinking mind, so that we can relax and be more spontaneous. In Zen, there used to be a lot of talk about spontaneity, and the original Beatnik way of understanding Zen was about being so spontaneous that anything goes and anything went in those days. But this kind of spontaneity is true freedom. Freedom because one can see how impermanent things are and how indeterminate they are. There's no longer the anxiety to nail things down, to make them hold still, to try to control them when they're already slipping away. So it's a way to be more natural, more easy with oneself and more easy with other people. And this is the point where he says, the transmission of lineage and precepts is complete. Meaning that the student and the teacher have complete understanding between them. So, this is a bit about transmission also. So this isn't the last one either. You would think that the Dharmakaya would be the last one, and it's not. And then you would think that this Sambhogakaya one, the returning to the source, would certainly be the last one. But no, there's a tenth one called Entering the Marketplace. And that one is the Nirmanakaya, the Shakyamuni Buddha, the embodiment Buddha. So after all this effort and difficulty and then transcendence, apparent transcendence, then it's going back. We'll talk about the going back some more next week. I wanted to read to you what Weineng said about the kayas, because he's such a trip. He talks about taking refuge first, and he says, "Good people, let each of you examine yourself. Do not use your mind mistakenly. Scripture clearly says to take refuge in the Buddha in oneself, not to take refuge in another Buddha. If you do not resort to your own inherent Buddha, you have nothing to rely on." Now that you are self-realized, each of you should take refuge in the three treasures in your own mind. Inwardly tame the nature of mind. Outwardly respect other people. This is called self-refuge. Then he says, "Good friends, once you have taken refuge in the three treasures in yourself, let each of you focus your mind, and I will explain to you the Buddha of our own nature as three embodiments of one substance, to enable you to see the three embodiments and clearly realize your own essential nature by yourself." And then he has people take the refuge. "Let everyone follow me," and saying, "I take refuge in the Buddha as the pure body of reality in my own physical body. I take refuge in the Buddha as the fulfilled body of reward in my own physical body. I take refuge in the Buddha as thousands of hundreds of millions of projected bodies in my own physical body. Good friends, the physical body is a house. It cannot be called a resort or a refuge. The aforementioned Buddha in three embodiments is in our own essential nature. Everyone in the world has it, but because of confusion in their own minds, they do not see their inner nature. And so they seek a three-bodied Tathagata externally, not seeing that they have Buddha in three embodiments within their own bodies." There's a bit more, but I think that's enough. This is a wonderful gift. So, are there questions? There must be questions.
I think it's wonderful always in Dharma talks. You know, I know I often come in and I don't have anything on my mind and I'm just open to what you're saying. Today I came in was something I wanted to ask you about, and I didn't know if I should ask during the thing or after. And lo and behold, the last section of your talk was directly addressing what I was going to ask. And I think it happens not infrequently. It's very interesting.
Yeah.
The Dharma really kind of has a way of addressing us. It's beautiful. The question had to do with the role of anxiety. And I was trying to understand, first of all, from a practice point of view, where does that come from? Then I was trying to relate it to the three poisons, and I guess it might be maybe a kind of ignorance, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't quite know where to fashion it in that structure.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it's not important. But the other question is, though, is when we recognize we are anxious about something, we are trying to control it, right? The reason we are anxious, I think, is we want something to go our way.
Yes.
Is the very recognition of the anxiety enough to let it go and return to our practice?
Mm-hmm.
Is that sufficient?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's just weather.
It's just what?
Weather.
Weather? It's a little storm and it...
Yeah, it's a cloud that comes through. You can get attached to it and make it into something else. You know, it can become an obsession. And it's one way that we can kind of cultivate our sense of ourself. You know, there are lots of habitual tics like that, that though they seem uncomfortable, are actually kind of a pleasure because then we're somebody. You know, if we're just going along with things, then our sense of who we are isn't necessarily so vivid.
What happens when we're anxious in a, I don't want to make this sound too grandiose, in a bodhisattva way, as opposed to being anxious about ourself? So if we're participating, you know, maybe you're doing bells and you haven't done them in a while and you're anxious mm-hmm. about doing them right.
Mm-hmm.
Now that's not a me thing. That's a how can I give the bells to the Sangha, and yet I'm still anxious about it. Is that the same kind of anxiety as anxiety turned to the self? I want to give these bells because I want to sound good. I guess that's a question of really what's going on. But can you be anxious in a good way if it's outward oriented?
Well, I don't know. It's what I'm thinking of is I've forgotten whose story. Maybe it's Jack Kornfield's story of traveling in some foreign country with a cab driver driving down a mountain, he and his teacher, and the cab driver is driving hell-bent for leather, and they're careening down the mountain, and the young student is being very, very careful not to show his terror, and trying to be very holy and cool, and finally at the bottom of the mountain, the teacher turns to him and says, "That was really scary, wasn't it?" And he's shocked because he thought, you know, the teacher wouldn't be anxious. But of course that we have anxiety all the time. We're animals and we want to survive and it's built into us. So, but anxiety can become a way of creating and recreating ourselves. And self-importance, and you know that. And I would say, if you're worried about making a mistake with the bells, it might be your self-importance that's suffering a little bit there, because nobody's going to care. Unfortunately.
also wonder if. Just like any performance, I mean, I used to get so anxious, almost mm-hmm. get diarrhea, that scary, but I've learned from my teacher, the piano teacher, that the more you do it, the easier it gets. The first time it's really scary, and I think that's natural.
Yeah, yeah.
I almost want to take away the self thing from that. I mean, it's natural to be nervous. And the second time is a little bit easier, maybe not a lot easier, and so forth.
That's one of the biggest fears, is performing in front of a group of people. They say that's one of the most greatest fears in human being. You know, greater than fighting a fire or jumping off a cliff or any of those things. That just appearing in front of a group is the hardest thing.
And some people are more nervous than others. Some people enjoy it. So I think maybe it's important to realize that that's kind of how you are. Maybe shy, maybe, you know, just not a performer and you're just trying to do something. And maybe related to life.
It's a very interesting question about what appears, what it is to be an appearance, and how it is that we appear for each other, and our anxiety. We have many anxieties around that. You know, and there are conventions about how we're supposed to dress, how we're supposed to speak, how we interchange ourselves with others. And it works pretty well as long as we're all agreed. But if we turn up in another country with another language and other customs, then suddenly there's the whole question of appearance becomes very, very anxiety-provoking. And partly I think it's because of the red ant, black ant mind, that there's a primitive part of our mind that automatically dismisses, if not fears, what's different. If things are too different, it becomes scary for us. And then we either go into a kind of attack mode or a retreat mode, but in any case, it's still... and I think, you know, even in a world like the one that we live in, There are enough differences that we can do this red ant, black ant thing without even noticing it often. It's the source of much of our social discontinuity and suffering.
In like this, the return, I don't know, like, I was kind of thinking of in Empire Strikes Back, like, this big thing where Luke Skywalker learns that Darth Vader is his father.
Yeah.
But I'm not getting that sense of drama in this particular... I'm trying to figure out what that is. I mean, is there kind of a reckoning, so to speak, maybe is in this kind of moment of returning?
I don't think so. I think it's more a recognition. It's like recognizing something that you've sort of known all along. So it's not a dramatic thing. It's more, well, it's returning home. So it's familiar already. But there is that Darth Vader, I mean, the recognition that something you maybe suspected but didn't know comes true.
I mean, in all these different, I mean, I guess I'm talking about, like, more hero stories, like these
epics,
where there always seems to, like, this notion of returning. I mean, Matrix, there's this big kind of twist where it's like the bottom all falls out, like everything that you thought was isn't, but there's things you've already known, but what are you going to do now, kind of thing.
Yes. Yeah, I think that is certainly what this is about also. Yeah. for enjoying the truth of our own embodied life. This marvelous ability to live and breathe on this earth. Okay.
I was struck by the second book you read about the Buddha, with finding the Buddha within yourself, and not an outer Buddha. And, I think that's happened to me recently, and something that I was dealing with. And I've been reading this book about the precepts, a different book, and kind of getting this message that the way I was thinking about things wasn't the right way or something. But I kind of know myself enough to know, all right, I'm being very influenced by this book, so let me think about it some more and not just see what this book says. And sitting and being uncomfortable for a while, I think I came up with a solution that felt right to me and was completely probably contradicting what this book would say. Although I know that in the book she's saying, I'm not saying this is how you should be. I mean, you know how it was a very Zen Buddhist book, but I can't help when I read something to think, oh, well, that's how I should do it. You know, that sounds like the right and noble way to do it. So, anyway, I felt like when I was actually carrying out my solution, I felt really good about it. And I kind of discarded years of turmoil and conflict over what to do about this situation. And that's kind of how I decided that was the right thing to do, because I felt really just good about it. And since then, I've had this huge weight lifted off my shoulders. But I thought about that. It's like, you got to follow your own Buddha.
Yes. Yes. So. Thank you. Perfect example. Congratulations.
That's amazing. God, I've been worrying about this thing for at least a year or more. Uh-huh. And I'm finally taking care of it.
Well, that's a great way to end this. Thank you. Thank you all.